Buenas tardes, bienvenidos a esta actividad, una actividad más de este coloquio internacional. Estamos absolutamente encantados con el desarrollo del mismo. Yo creo que está siendo muy enriquecedor para todos los participantes y también para las personas que han acudido a algunas de sus actividades. Hoy mi función va a ser simplemente la de presentar al presentador, porque voy a ceder el honor a Isaac Kerub de que presente a nuestro invitado de honor, que es Yehuda Bauer. Simplemente, para los que no le conocen, pero veo en esta sala muchos rostros amigos, o sea, creo que ya le conocen, pero Isaac Kerub Caro es el presidente de la Federación de Comunidades Judías de España. Quiere decir que es el interlocutor del Estado a efectos de lo que son la organización de las comunidades judías españolas y su relación con el Estado español. Aparte de eso, en todas las actividades, también es el presidente de Yad Vashem en España. Y para mí es, aparte de un entrañable amigo, una persona con la que tengo una relación profesional y personal pues entrañable, ¿no? Con lo cual, para mí es un verdadero placer, como ya ha ocurrido en otras muchas ocasiones, que nos acompañe y que esté hoy aquí. Y también es un verdadero placer cederle el honor de que presente a nuestro ponente de hoy. Con lo cual, Isaac, cuando quieras.
Muchas gracias, Miguel. Buenas tardes a todos. En mi calidad de presidente de la Federación y de Comunidades Judías de España y de presidente Yad Vashem en España, Miguel de Lucas ha tenido a bien invitarme a participar en este seminario tan interesante y como director del Centro Sefará de Israel me ha pedido que presente esta tarde al profesor Bauer. En tiempos de asedio y de guerra, el que no está con uno está contra ti. Durante la Segunda Guerra Mundial, la neutralidad de algunos países ha sido y sigue siendo un tema polémico y controvertido. En cuanto a las posibilidades de un rescate por parte de los países aliados de los judíos durante la noche más larga de la humanidad, este es un tema aún sujeto a debate. Antes de la guerra, los judíos intentaron por todos los medios quedarse en sus respectivos países y los alemanes presionaron todo lo posible para conseguir que aquellos se fueran. Pero ya en 1941, en vísperas de la adopción de la solución final de la cuestión judía en Europa, todos los judíos en la Europa dominada por los alemanes querían salir. Pero entonces la maquinaria de destrucción y muerte alemana los mantenía cautivos. Precisamente para hablar de todo ello tenemos el honor de tener entre nosotros al profesor Yehuda Bauer. El profesor Yehuda Bauer es israelí, nacido en Praga en 1926, inmigró a Palestina en 1939, sirvió en las filas del Palmaj entre 1944 y 1945, estudió en la Universidad de Cardiff, en País de Gales, entre 1947 y 1950, participó en la Guerra de Independencia en 1948, fue miembro del Kibbutz Shoval en el desierto del Negev entre 1952 y 1993, obtuvo su doctorado en la Universidad Hebrea de Jerusalén en 1960, es presidente honorífico del International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance desde 2005, es presidente fundador del Centro Vidal Sassoon para el Estudio del Antisemitismo, es el fundador de la Revista para los Estudios sobre el Holocausto y el Genocidio, es presidente del Instituto de Investigación de Yad Vashem en Jerusalén, es asesor académico para Yad Vashem en la actualidad, es miembro de la Academia de Ciencias en Israel desde el año 2000, es asesor del gobierno de Suecia para el Foro de Estocolmo, es Premio Israel en 1998. Como saben ustedes, ha hablado en multitud de foros. Yo destacaría que habló ante el Parlamento alemán el 27 de enero de 1998 y ante la Asamblea General de la ONU el 27 de enero de 2006. Ha escrito multitud de libros, fundamentalmente sobre el tema del Holocausto, y ha publicado más de 100 artículos en diferentes periódicos. Esta noche disertará acerca de si el rescate fue una posibilidad realista durante el Holocausto. Was rescue realistic possibility during the Holocaust? Cedo pues la palabra al profesor Yehuda Bauer. Professor Bauer, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for having me here and for this highly interesting and very informative conference that we are having, and for the honor of giving a grant in my name. Normally this happens only when the person for whom you give the grant is safely dead, which in my case is not quite the situation. So, however, thank you very much nevertheless. Let me try to put this into some kind of a perspective. The total number of victims of the Holocaust, Jews who died as a result of Nazi policies, is about 5.7 million, not the 6 million that we mythologically repeat all the time. What we are discussing here at this conference, when you take it all together, the neutral countries and people who claim to have citizenship or did have citizenship of neutral countries and who were living under Nazi rule, amounts to maybe 20 to 30,000 people, all told, the highest figure possible. The number of rescued was, of course, as we heard, much, much smaller than that. Now compare this. We are dealing with a very small population in comparison with a tremendous event of world significance, which will be with us for many generations to come. So, what are the proportions there? In the end, what we are discussing here is a marginal issue. Right? It's a very important marginal issue. The contradiction is that this is a crucially important, very marginal issue. And I think unless we realize those proportions and keep them in our minds, we don't really understand what we are dealing with. Now, you see, there is a school of thought, basically in America, which argues in the wake of a very important American historian, David S. Wyman, that America especially, but Anglo-American policies generally, were co-responsible for the murder of European Jews. And people who write that don't realize that the intent of the Germans was to kill every single Jew defined as a Jew by the perpetrators everywhere, all over the globe. So it's not just European Jewry. Now, David S. Wyman is, and he's very much alive and hopefully will be so for a long time to come, is the son of Swedish Lutheran missionaries, motivated by a very strong moral imperative. The people who follow him are almost all of them American Jewish historians. And the argument that they are putting forward is a very serious argument. Namely, that during the 30s, America could have saved tens of thousands and more European Jews from the genocide. The quota of immigrants from Germany and Austria was 27,370. If all that quota had been used between 1933 and the end of 1941, when America entered the war, or was entered into the war by the attack of the Japanese and by the German declaration of war, then maybe some 230,000 Jews, because 85% of all immigrants from Germany and Austria during the 30s were Jews, maybe 230,000 Jews could have been saved, whereas in actual fact, only some 85,000 Jews made it to America. So the American government, the Roosevelt administration, who had control over the visas, could have saved some 150,000 more Jews. And the fact that they didn't is a terrible blot on American traditions. This is the argument. Then from 1939 to the end of 1941, when immigration from Europe to America became, in practice, more or less impossible, they could have done the same. They knew what was happening in Europe, 1939, 1940, 1941, that's the argument. They could have intervened, they could have rescued, they didn't do it. And the Jewish community in America split into factions, was incapable of organizing a common policy towards the administration. And after the American entry into the war, from 1942 to 1944, the same thing happens. The American government did not do anything in order to rescue the Jews of Europe. In fact, on small-scale rescue plans, they vetoed them. The Jewish organizations in America quarreled with each other, and it was left to a small group of extreme right-wing Zionists centered around five emissaries of the right-wing underground, Jewish underground in Palestine, known in English as the Irgun, or in Hebrew as Etzel, who were sent to America to get funds and make propaganda, but left that. And then in 1942 and 1943, tried to recruit the American public to pressure the American administration to rescue the Jews of Europe. And as a result of that pressure, Roosevelt had to yield and created, as we heard this morning, created the War Refugee Board on 22nd of January 1944. And that was a tremendous success, so it is argued. Some 400,000 Jews were saved by the War Refugee Board between January 44 and the end of the war. That's the argument. Let me try to examine that. In the 1930s, oh yes, and the argument for moreover is that Roosevelt, the person, the individual, was not only no friend of the Jews, but in fact he had anti-Semitic tendencies. And only quite recently they published material trying to prove that. And of course, if the president was sort of half anti-Semitic, then this is part of the explanation why the American government didn't do a thing in order to rescue the Jews of Europe. Now, in the 1930s, Roosevelt was elected in order to solve the question of the mass unemployment and the Great Depression in America, with 17 million unemployed, with a real, real danger of an overturning the democratic character of the United States of America. And his primary task was to do that with a very complicated coalition of ethnic groups, Irish, Italian, Jewish, black, with the liberal middle class concentrated largely in the Northeast, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania and California, and with the essential aid of reactionary, racist, anti-Semitic Democrats in the South and the Southwest of America. Without them, it couldn't be done. Now, that very complicated coalition was led by Roosevelt during the 30s in order to save America. Now, the Jews were part of that coalition, so he had to do something for them. His own attitude, I think I can prove it, was of a liberal American aristocrat. Did he like Jews? He had Jewish, not friends. Roosevelt didn't have any friends at all. He had colleagues and collaborators and people who were invited to his home, and quite a number of them were Jewish. His speechwriter was Samuel Rosenman. One of his major economic advisors was Bernard Baruch. He was a great friend of Jewish lawyers, Brandeis, Frankfurter, and so on. And of course, his Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr. Now, they came in and out of his home. Does that mean that he loved Jews? No. He didn't love anyone in particular. What was his attitude to Jews in the aggregate? You know, there's that famous apocryphal story of the British clerk or official in the Foreign Office who is supposed to have been asked by a superior to define anti-Semitism. And he said, anti-Semitism is to dislike the Jews more than is normal. And Roosevelt was a normal person. He didn't like them, he didn't hate them. They were part of the reality of a multi-social, multi-racial America, which he wanted to keep democratic, in both sense democratic. Democratic as a system and democratic as a political party. He did something for the Jews. Now you see, this business with the quota, the 27,370, okay? Wyman, who is the father of this argument, actually in the first chapter of one of the two great books that he wrote, recognizes the fact that America in the 30s was isolationist, restrictionist, anti-immigrationist, and anti-Semitic. You can read it there. It's there. He wrote two books, Wyman. Wonderful books, really wonderfully researched. Paper Walls, dealing with the 30s in 1968. The Abandonment of the Jews in 1984. And they are the foundation of the argument that I presented to you. What does abandonment of the Jews mean? If you have a child or a spouse that you loved or you cared for or you were responsible for, you can abandon that person. It's very bad. You can't abandon somebody that you never protected. The Jews were never wards of America. They were part of the immigration to America. Okay, fine. They made it there. They were very successful, on the whole, in the aggregate, over time, not at first, so on. Like others. Did America ever say, we protect the Jews of the world? We protect the Jews of Europe? Could America have abandoned the Jews? They were never protected by America. America couldn't. When Wyman uses that term, unconsciously, I think, he's a very brilliant man. That's the Lutheran heritage. You know, morality. You are responsible. Now, okay, you are responsible. The Jews in Europe were not American citizens. America had no legal responsibility for them. You could argue that America had a moral responsibility for endangered people. Okay, that's quite true. Then what about the Chinese murdered in Nanjing in 1937 by the Japanese? Didn't America have a responsibility to the Chinese? Only to the Jews? Because the assumption, you see, of that school of thought is that America knew there was going to be a Holocaust. They were going to rescue or not rescue Jews from what? From genocide. But nobody knew that a genocide would happen. Nobody. Not Weizmann, not Jabotinsky, not Ben-Gurion, none of the Jews. Certainly none of the non-Jews. None of the Germans. Until Hitler's speech in the Reichstag on January 30, 1939, no German leader ever threatened the Jews with a genocide. And when Hitler made his speech, he was of course cheered by the Nazis, you know, in the Reichstag. But there was no planning behind it. My friends, the Holocaust was not a planned genocide. It was something that developed in stages on the basis of an ideology. The ideology was never explicit about genocide. It was a logical conclusion that if all other means failed, then that would be the solution. So it wasn't planned. You know, on the 25th of May, 1940, Heinrich Himmler submitted a memorandum to the Führer, 25th of May. Remember when that is? That's 15 days after the German invasion of Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France, right? Hitler is on the Western Front in a bunker. Now, he's got other business to see to. But he reads that memorandum by Himmler on how to treat the peoples in German-occupied Poland, in that part of Poland that was occupied by Germany. The Poles, the Ukrainians, the small ethnic groups there, the Mazurs, the Kashubs, the Hutsus, and so on and so forth, the Jews, the Lithuanians. And he says, yes, well, they'll be taught to count until 500, and they'll be able to sign their names, and they should be taught to obey Germans. That's enough. The Jews will be deported to Africa somewhere. And then he adds a sentence in the middle. Any solution of that solution, these solutions are better than the annihilation of a national group, which is a Bolshevik policy, un-German, and impossible, unmöglich. And Hitler writes on the margins of that document, very correct. No, not on that sentence, but generally, sehr richtig. That's 1 year before they start murdering the Jews. The Holocaust was not pre-planned. It couldn't have been foreseen, not by Roosevelt, not by anyone. And it wasn't foreseen. What they were trying to do was to help Jews flee from a violently anti-Semitic, reactionary, frightful regime in Germany, and then Austria, and then Bohemia, and so on. Yeah? And Roosevelt did something. At the end of 1935, he intervened and said to the visa department, you have to be a little bit more generous. And so the numbers of the Jews, the Jews who entered America in 1935-6 was higher than that of 1934-5, and the 1936-7 was still higher, 10,000, over 10,000 in 35-36, 17,000 in 37-38, and then in 38-39, the number was over the quota, so 35,000, over the quota, because they permitted visitors to come in and the visitors then stayed, yeah? So he did something. The Evian Conference was a flop. But the Evian Conference was a real attempt by Roosevelt to do something for the Jews because they were part of his coalition, because he thought Nazism was terrible and something had to be done to save these people. And then he invented these fantastic, impossible plans to settle the Jews in Alaska and in Mindanao in the Philippines and in British Guiana in the northern part of South America and so on. Silly ideas. And he believed in that. He thought, you have to solve this in a big way. You can't do it in a small way. And we are talking about 500,000 Jews in Germany. We are talking about 200,000 Jews in Austria. We're talking about 135,000 Jews in Czechoslovakia, all of Czechoslovakia. Small numbers compared with Poland, compared with Jews in the Soviet Union, which nobody thought of at that moment. And then Wyman and his pupils come along and say, they should have rescued them. Come on. Now, the period of 1939 to 1941, a very important period when the Germans were going to win the war, right? They conquered France, Scandinavia, in 1941, the Balkans. What exactly should America have done? It was still neutral, right? Between 1939 and the end of 1941. There was no American army worth its name. There's no American Air Force. The American Intelligence Service was a joke. Bad joke. There was a Neutrality Act in America. Roosevelt had to obey it. He couldn't go beyond it because otherwise the Congress would turn against him. At the end of 1940, he wanted to be re-elected for the third time as president. So he couldn't go against the Congress. And he was a politician, first and foremost. But you see, what people like the pupils of Wyman, I don't want to mention too many names, what they say, what they ignore completely is the conduct of the war. In September 1940, my friends, many of you know this, the Americans and the British arrived at a lend-lease arrangement whereby the Americans supplied destroyers, American destroyers, to the British, because the British were losing more ships in the Atlantic to German U-boats than they were building. So destroyers to find the new boats. And in return, the British handed over to the Americans military bases in British colonial possessions in the Caribbean and on the American continent, Belize and British Guiana. Why? Why don't people go to archives and study, for instance, the discussions between the American High Command in 1940 and the State Department? It's quite clear to them that there's a real, not possibility, probability that the Germans are going to win the war in Europe and that Britain is not going to last. And the Germans are going to occupy all of Europe, including Britain. And then there will be a danger of German military posts, positions, in European colonies in the Americas. And so in order to avoid that, we'll give the British these old destroyers and we'll get the military bases on the basis on the idea that the war in Europe is lost. September 1940. Rescue Jews. Don't be funny. Now, what did the Americans know about what was happening to the Jews in Europe? In 1940, everything. Because there were American journalists in Europe. You can find reports, detailed reports, on what was happening in ghettos in Poland during that period. The idea of the Germans in 1940 in Poland was not to kill the Jews, an industrial murder, but to expel them. In 1939, when they occupied the western part of Poland, with Hitler's explicit intervention, the idea was to concentrate them in the southeastern part of newly occupied Poland and then push them over into the Soviet Union. Quite recently, a Soviet document was found in which there was a report that the Germans have approached us to accept Jews from German-occupied Poland and accept them into the Soviet Union. And our answer, of course, was, no, thank you very much. So that didn't work. We all know that there were attempts, people were deported there and so on, and then it collapsed. Then the second idea was this idea of that Himmler articulated as well, to deport them to Africa, specifically to Madagascar. We all know about that. This was not yet industrial murder, although it was actually a killing process which was envisaged. A slow killing process. The idea was to keep the Jews in Madagascar, all the European Jews in Madagascar, to ensure the good behavior of the Jews in America. When that didn't work, because you can't swim to Madagascar, and the sea was controlled by the British, the third plan was in January 1941, articulated by Heydrich in Prague, to a select group of Nazis, to put all the European Jews in the to-be-conquered Soviet Arctic, because in January 1941, they already knew they were going to attack the Soviet Union. Now, the first two projects were known in the West. Not exactly, but as rumors, as information, which was not quite certain. The third idea with the Arctic, that was not known at all. That was completely unknown. But that wasn't industrial killing yet either. It was very near to it, but not yet. And then on June 22nd, as we all know, 1941, the Germans invade the Soviet Union. Then what we know today as the Holocaust, which is the genocide of the Jewish people, started. The planning went along with the actual exercise of the genocide. The genocide was based on a consensus: kill as many Jews as possible. And then the planning comes along with it. And by the fall of 1941, they were already beginning to plan the extension of the Holocaust in Poland, at first local, Chelno, September 41, the first planning, and then on the 8th of December 1941, the beginning of the operations in the gassing of Jews in Chelno. That was a regional annihilation program. And then it became an all Polish annihilation program with the beginning of the planning of the Belzec death camp, and then later on Sobibor, Treblinka, and so on and so forth. So you see, what was known about that? Well, the Americans didn't, and the West generally, between June 1941, the invasion of the Soviet Union, and the end of the war, at the end of the year, the American entry into the war, there were rumors. The Soviets reported about two major massacres, one in Kamenets-Podolsky in August 1941. The figures were wrong, but the basis was correct. This was reported by a Swedish journalist who based himself on Hungarian testimonies and so on. And then in September, the Babi Yar massacre in Kiev. Again, the figures were wrong that the Soviets published, but the facts were correct. In other words, there was a major massacre there. The West considered this to be unconfirmed rumors, probably something correct there, but not quite clear what. And apart from that, the fact that close to about a million Jews were killed in that half year in the occupied Soviet Union was really unknown. Rumors, you see, here and there. Now, assuming for a moment that the rumors hadn't been rumors and the Americans had accepted the information, now what exactly could they have done? They were still neutral. Bomb occupied Soviet Union with a non-existent American Air Force? Invade the area with a non-existent American army? What exactly should they have done? When, in January 1942, the Russians, the Soviets, announced that there were mass murders and they mentioned Jews. Molotov mentioned Jews on the 6th of January 1942. This was considered very good propaganda against the Germans. Was it true? But maybe a little bit, you know. These things don't happen in the 20th century. There's a very serious American historian, one of the best, Richard Brightman. And Brightman published a book called Official Secrets. And in that book he quotes the deciphering of German police radio messages between mid-July and mid-September 1941, just after the invasion of the Soviet Union, in which the German police report, we've killed so many people and so on, and very often Jews are mentioned. Now this was top secret, you know, the fact that the British had broken the German code. The place where they did this is called Bletchley Park, and the program was called Enigma. And they supplied that information in small bits only to the Admiralty when it concerned naval issues, only to the army when it concerned questions of German disposition of armed forces, and the only person who was not actually a high military commander who got this was Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill got this information about the German police in the Soviet Union. And there was a British lieutenant in Bletchley Park who analyzed this and said, it's quite clear that the Germans are killing the Jews everywhere they possibly can. And Churchill underlined that in his typical red pencil you see on him. And he used that information without mentioning the Jews in a BBC broadcast on the 24th of August 1941. And of course, the British intelligence, the MI6, were absolutely aghast. The Germans are going to hear that broadcast. They're going to realize that their code was broken. But the Germans didn't catch on. But from that moment, from the 24th of August, Bletchley Park no longer sent any decrypts of German codes to Winston Churchill because he was unreliable. So did the West know what was happening? No. When did they know? When the Bund, the Polish Jewish anti-Zionist and anti-religious political underground, which represented a plurality of Polish Jews, the Polish Jews in their vast majority no longer were Orthodox. They voted 38% Bund, 35% Zionist, 23% Orthodox in 1938-39. So there goes your nostalgia. And when the Bund, the underground Bund, managed through Sweden to get a report out in May 1942, that report said that 700,000 Jews, Polish Jews, they didn't know about anyone else, had been murdered in Poland by the Germans by that time, May 1942. This was published. It was published on the 5th of June. It was broadcast on the 5th of June. On the 25th of June, it was published in British newspapers. Afterwards, in the back pages of American newspapers as well. It was not, there was no silence. The world was silent, Elie Wiesel says. Pure nonsense. They didn't do anything, but silent they were not. And then in August 1942, the famous Riga telegram cable came from Geneva, which is based on the information by a German anti-Nazi, an industrialist by the name of Eduard Schulte, that said, in the fall, 3.5 million Jews are going to be killed at one blow with the aid of prussic acid. Prussic acid, of course, is the major component of what we know as Cyclone B, which was the gas used in Auschwitz. In the future, this is after 42 in September, in August. This is after about 3 million Jews had already been killed, you know? This is when the Jews arrived. And the Americans, of course, didn't believe it, and rightly so. Because the cable said, the last sentence said, in the cable said, we are not sure that the information that we are transmitted is correct. So what do you expect a government to do, a Jewish community to do? Maybe it's not correct, maybe it's panic. So the Americans took their time until they found out from a important personality in the International Red Cross in Switzerland, Jakob Burckhardt, in early November 1942, that indeed this was correct. And then the central figure of American jurist, Stephen S. Wise, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, went to the press, to the American press, with that information, and said, "This is now approved by the State Department." It was published in the New York Times on page 7, along with some other information about Jews in Lithuania and so on. Nobody believed it. And had they believed it, what could they have done? Please tell me. Bomb? The American Air Force started bombing Germany in February 1943. Why don't they check archives? Why don't they find out what the military operations were? Yeah? So, bomb where? Bomb concentration camps? Kill all the inmates there? Did they know about Auschwitz? Auschwitz was a terrible concentration camp. Rumors had it that there was gassing there. There's a famous and tremendously important memoir by the last political head of the Polish underground in Poland, Stefan Korboński. Now, maybe pupils of Wyman and so on don't know Polish. They should learn it, at least enough to read it, or else get a PhD student to translate it for them. Stefan Korboński writes that in 1942, when the Jews of Warsaw were being deported to Treblinka, he reported it to London, including the fact that the Jews in Treblinka were murdered by gas. And nothing happens. And he didn't understand that. There was no reaction by the Polish government or by the British government, to which, of course, finally this information was intended. A year later, in 43, they dropped a Polish parachutist from London in Poland. And Korboński asked him, this is in the memoir, "Why on earth didn't you do something with my information?" And the man said, "Look, nobody believed it. They said you were a bit too extreme in your anti-German sentiments. This doesn't happen in the 20th century." Okay? The Post did give information to the British. Exactly what information, I don't know. I tried to find out for years. But German bombs destroyed the archive of the British representation and the Polish government in exile in London. So it's very difficult. There is a book, you won't believe this. It was published in Oświęcim, in the Auschwitz Museum, in 1968, under the communists, which talks about the concentration camp in Auschwitz, the reports to London by the AKA, by the right-wing underground. The communists were against it, but nevertheless, they published that book. Nobody has yet gone to examine the sources of that book. But yes, that book says that we reported to London, and nobody believed. Even after the Allied declared on the 17th of December 1942 that the Jews of Europe were being murdered by the Germans, and the Germans will be held responsible for it. The perpetrators will be. after that, the British intelligence, I can show this, said internally, very good propaganda, can't possibly be true. They did so even after the end of the war. So could the West have rescued the millions of Jews? They should have bombed Poland when they could. Well, when could they bomb Poland? British Lancaster bombers had a range of 4,600 kilometers, which was certainly enough to go to Poland and back. But they didn't have fighter escorts. They had only Spitfires and Mosquitoes and that sort of stuff, had a range of 500 kilometers and couldn't go beyond Berlin. You know, the British and the Americans did not bomb East Germany because they couldn't reach there, because they didn't have fighter escort. Their bombers would have been shot out of the sky like flying ducks. So in November 43, a new fighter came into service, Anglo-American fighter, with a Rolls-Royce British engine and American equipment and structure. The P-51 Mustang, and that had a huge range. And from then on, they could reach Poland. But by November 43, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec and Chełmno were no longer operative. Only Auschwitz was. And Auschwitz, we're not quite clear what's happening there. It wasn't until the escape of first two and then another two Jews from Auschwitz. The first two were Alfred Wetzler and Rudolf Virba, who escaped from Auschwitz on April 7, 1944, reached Slovakia on 21st of April and reported. And that report reached Switzerland on the 11th of June. It was not easy to transmit information like that. In the meantime, two other people escaped, Czesław Mordovic and Arnold Rosin. They escaped exactly a month later. And the report, the combined report of the four, as I said, reached Switzerland, and from there a gist reached the War Refugee Board. They could have bombed Auschwitz then. The only way to bomb Auschwitz and hit the gas chambers was to do carpet bombing, because there was no precision bombing in World War II. So the people who were in Auschwitz, the inmates, the Jews, wanted that to happen, but nobody knew that. Bombing Auschwitz was against the policy of the Allies. In January 44, the combined chiefs of staff in Washington decided that military means were not going to be used for civilian purposes. Auschwitz was not a military target. Auschwitz III was a military target. Monowitz, the Buna factory, that was bombed. Very unsuccessfully, but that was bombed. Auschwitz was a civilian thing. The decision in January 44 not to use military force was not connected to Jews to Auschwitz, it was connected to the French resistance, who wanted allies to bomb French prisons so that the resistors could escape. And the Allies said, no, we need our bombers only for military targets. Could they have bombed Auschwitz? Of course they could have bombed Auschwitz. After June 44, could that have saved Hungarian Jews? No, because the Hungarian Jewish deportations were stopped on July 9th. And the You know, the information arrived on June 11th and so on and so forth. In July, they could have bombed Auschwitz, from July on. But they could have damaged the German installations. It is highly unlikely that they would have hit all the four gas chambers in Birkenau. Highly unlikely, individual buildings. Had they hit them and destroyed them, would the Germans have then stopped killing Jews? Of course not. When the Germans stopped gas chambers at the end of October 1944, after that, some close to 400,000 Jews were murdered between that time and the end of the war, in death marches and all kinds of situations. The Germans didn't need gas chambers. It was more convenient than other forms of killing, yeah. But they weren't dependent on that. And killing Jews was more important than many other things for the German war machine. For the German, not a war machine, for the German machine. The Jews of Europe, the millions, were doomed the moment Hitler declared war. But thousands could have been saved. Thousands. Many thousands. And the Anglo-Americans refused even the most minimal help, the most minimal intervention with the neutrals, for instance. These were demands presented by Jewish organizations. Why don't you promise the neutrals to keep any refugees alive that reach the borders of the neutral countries? This is micro history. This is the margin. But what a margin. The Jewish tradition says that to save one person is to save a whole world. These were thousands of worlds that could have been saved. Only small numbers of Jews could have reached Palestine after 1941. It is nonsense to say that the British prevented hundreds of thousands of Jews of entering Palestine. Pure nonsense. But yes, thousands could have come with great difficulty because the Germans didn't permit them to go. And the Turks didn't want to get them to allow them to go through. And there was a war in the Aegean that was sinking ships. So you see, they could have saved the few that could have, a few thousands. I don't know how many thousands, tens of thousands could have been saved. They weren't. Until the very end of the war, I would argue to a certain extent until today, the Allies did not realize what war they were fighting. They were fighting a traditional war against a terrible imperialist regime threatening a democratic world. They did not realize that they were fighting a genocidal ideological power of tremendous strength that was threatening the very basis of humanity. It's not the only ideological power like that. There are parallels. Fortunately for you, I have to stop because I could carry on for hours and tell you what I think about the rest of it. But let me finish with a micro history, which deals with Spain. Now, this is not, you know, my research, this is Chaim Avner's research, other people's research. You have in the joint, sits in Lisbon, first under Maurice Stroper, then under Joe Schwartz, and they want to help. You know, there are a few Jews who are crossing the Pyrenees, there are some of them arriving in Madrid, somehow. And the joint wants to give them money, but the joint cannot operate in Spain, as we all know, because it's a Jewish organization, and the friends of the joint The Quakers are a Protestant organization, so they also cannot work in Spain. So what you do? So they found a doorman, you know, in a hotel in Madrid. His name was Moshe Eisen. And Moshe Eisen received dollars from the joint, and he distributed to Jewish refugees in Madrid. That's how the joint, the great joint, operated to save thousands of Moshe Eisen. And when that sort of ended, there was this wonderful woman, the wife of the military attaché to this American embassy in Madrid, Dorsey Stevens, and she got the dollars from the joint, and she volunteered to distribute the money to these refugees. And in the meantime, in Barcelona, because of course the Jews who crossed the Pyrenees were put into Miranda el Ebro and so on, and the holding camp, a very unpleasant one, and there were some in Barcelona and so on and so forth. So how do you help them? There was this very shady character, an Austrian, who was maybe a Jew and maybe a non-Jew and maybe half a Jew, who knows. His name was Fred Max Oberländer. And Mr. Oberländer was a very shady character. And he got the dollars and distributed it, and the joint was trying to find somebody else. And so Samuel Sequeira, whom Chaim mentioned today, who was of course the secretary of the Jewish Refugee Organization in Lisbon, with the agreement of his boss, de Sagui, Augusto de Sagui, went with a Red Cross document to Barcelona, not with a joint document because that was Jewish, went to Barcelona to distribute some money. You see, this is microhistory. This is very important microhistory. This is what you've been doing today and yesterday. It's very important because it shows what maybe could have been done on a much larger scale but wasn't, because of all kinds of things that you all know about. What is my conclusion? Well, first of all, I have no conclusion. But secondly, I think that the Jews of Europe could not have been saved by the Anglo-Americans. But those who could have been saved by the Anglo-Americans were not saved. When the Bermuda Conference convened on the 19th of April, 1943, in order to deal with refugees, because there was the demand, especially in Britain, that something should be done for the Jews. And they decided ahead of time that they're not going to do anything, ahead of time. On that same day that the Warsaw Ghetto Rebellion broke out, 19th of April, 1943, when the conference in Bermuda met, the British delegate, Richard Law, who later became a lord in the British House of Lords, who was the undersecretary for Anthony Eden in the Parliament, who was the chief delegate of Britain to Bermuda, sends a cable to his boss, to Anthony Eden, which says, and I quote, "Sorry to bother you about Jews. I know what a bore it is." Thank you.